I never know exactly how I'm going to start off my talks. And I don't write my speeches out. I have to work off outlines. And so usually what happens is a few days before I come to a place, and I speak about 60 schools a year or something like that, something will happen. It'll be something in the news, or it'll be something, it's a conversation that I have with somebody. Sometimes it'll be a conversation that I have with one of the organizers of the event prior to actually getting to campus that will spark an idea in my head about how I'm going to discuss or begin to discuss the topic that I'm going to talk about tonight, which is essentially why white Americans should care about racial equity issues, why we should get active addressing issues of racial inequity, and really talking about making clear just how uncommitted I think white Americans by and large are to racial equity as of today and why that needs to change. Not a very easy topic to talk about, particularly on a campus that, despite what I saw last night at the Multicultural Affairs Awards, is still a white campus, despite the slight break in the clouds that I was able to witness last night with a lot of people of color strong in their commitment to changing the face of this university in many ways. And the thing that happened a few weeks ago, actually, that allowed me to know exactly how I wanted to jump into that topic, because it is a difficult topic to just jump right into, was I was having a conversation, the first conversation I had with Louis, when he called me to tell me about this event and sort of chat with me about the specifics. And I asked him, you know, what do you want me to talk about exactly in this speech? And he was saying, well, you know, we're wanting you to address why people who are not people of color, and I'm paraphrasing, but you'll remember this conversation, why people who aren't, you know, people of color and people who aren't racial and ethnic minorities, why they should get involved. And I said, you mean white people? And he sort of laughed, and white people. But it was a very telling moment, because it was one of those things that I think is really very much a metaphor for the way we talk about race in this country, which is to say, when we talk about racism, we talk about race issues, the word we never want to utter is white. And we don't want to talk about, we assume racism is about people of color. And indeed, people of color are the victims of it. But it's not an issue that is only a people of color issue. In fact, it's an issue because people who are not people of color and not racial and ethnic minorities, quote unquote, that is to say, because white people made it an issue from the inception of Western civilization, from the inception, certainly, of this nation. And so if we're not able, I'm not criticizing Louis for not being able to say it, most of us don't say it. Most of us don't just, and I said to him, I said, you can say white people with me, you know, that's okay, because I'm going to talk about white people. That's what I do most of the year. So, but we need to recognize that if we're going to discuss racism, we have to be able to say words like white, because if it weren't for the group called white, we wouldn't be, and understand what I mean. If it weren't for whiteness as a concept, if it weren't for the creation of whiteness as a concept, which is not, by the way, a biological concept, I hope that we're all clear on that. There is no genetic thing called white. There is no DNA structure that is unique to people of European descent that makes me different genetically from people of color. In fact, if you were to break down my DNA right now and compare it to the DNA of an African American in this room, I would have far more in common genetically with an African American than I would another so-called white person in the room. That's just a matter that any geneticist will be able to tell you, because there's more variation within a so-called racial or ethnic group than there is between them. This is just a matter of scientific fact. So when I'm talking about white people, I mean, understand, I'm not talking about as a biological entity. There is no such thing. But as a social entity, if it weren't for the creation of white people, because we were created, we didn't used to be called white people. We used to be called Europeans, Christians, we used to be called Englishmen, Irishmen, Scotch, German, etc. We were not white until about 1670. And that's when the laws of the country began to embody this notion that anyone who was of European descent would be on a level above anyone of color. That was the creation of whiteness, and it's what allowed immigrant white ethnics, poor working class white ethnics, Irish, Italian, Jews like my family from Russia, to come to this country and transcend their immigrant status and become white. So whiteness, were it not for that, we wouldn't even be having to talk about racism. The creation of whiteness is what has brought us to that point. And so when we talk about racism, we have to be willing to say the word white. And we have to do more than that. We have to be willing to talk about the implications of whiteness. We have to be willing to talk about white privilege. We have to be talking about institutional racism and the benefits that accrue to white people from that system. If we can't talk about that, we really ought not be talking about anything, because that is sort of the starting block of any discussion. So what I want to do tonight, if we have that discussion, is a couple of things. Really, it's to address a few of the myths that exist in this country with regard to this issue of whites and racism. The first myth is the notion that we already have racial equity in America, and therefore there's nothing for white folks to be fighting for. This is a very common misperception, that somehow when I say the title of the talk, really, tonight, that I'm giving, somewhat adapted, but the title that's in my press packet is, you know, Why Whites Must Join the Fight for Racial Equity. And sometimes people hear that title and they go, what do you mean, join the fight for racial equity? We have racial equity, so what is there to fight for? That's the first myth that I want to address. The second myth is the myth that, well, maybe there is a fight, but we're already on board. We're already committed to racial equity, so what do you mean why we have to join? Why, that's a done deal. We're already on board. We've been on board since 1964. You know, white folks have been champions for the last 30 years of racial equity, and we still are. That's the second myth that I want to address, because it's not true. It's not only not true nationwide, it's not true at the University of Oregon. I'm not talking about the white folks in this room, per se. I assume that you may, in fact, be committed to it. I'm talking about at the administrative level, and we'll talk about that. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'm only here 36 hours and I'm already going to criticize the institution, but I do that every day. But they're not here, from what I understand. The third thing I want to do is show how not only is it untrue that whites are on board this battle for racial equity, but in fact that we often attempt to evade responsibility for doing anything about racial equity, and I want to talk about some of those evasions. And then finally, I want to make the moral and the practical case, because I think they're both important, the moral and the practical case for why we should care. Because the reality is, if I do a good enough job standing up here and talking about white privilege, and if I do a good enough job persuading people that in fact it still exists, and that in fact institutional racism is still a problem, I've created somewhat of a catch-22 for white people. Because if I can prove to you it's still such a thing as white privilege, the obvious answer, if you're a white person, is, well, why the hell would I want to get rid of that? If you're right, why would I want to get rid of it? And that's a challenge, and it's not an easy challenge, but I'm going to offer both moral and practical reasons why I think, despite the existence of white privilege, we should, in fact, be willing to not relinquish it, because you can't just relinquish something like white privilege. You have to actually get active in attempting to undermine it and to abolish it at the institutional level. And I think there are both moral and practical reasons why we shouldn't make a few suggestions on why and how it should be. With regard to this first myth, this notion that equity already exists, so what's all the fuss? This kind of denial, which I think is really embedded very deeply in the white community, it exists in communities of color as well. I'm not saying that all people of color are clear on just how significant racism is. There are plenty of people of color who are not clear about the significance of racism. Some of them, like one of them, sits on the Supreme Court. And there are others who have positions of authority who are not at all clear, or at least if they are clear, they don't seem very committed to addressing that medicine. So understand, denial does cut across racial lines, but it is primarily a creation of and an instrument used by persons of European descent to evade responsibility for dealing with both the legacy of what has gone before and what continues today. According to data in 1995, a survey in 95, about 60% of all white Americans, 6 out of 10, say that black Americans have equal opportunity to get a good education or even better opportunity to get a good education than we as white folks. 80% say that blacks and Latinos have an equal or better chance than we do to get a good job or to earn a high income. 60% of whites say that blacks and Latinos, in fact, people of color generally, have a better chance at good housing than we as white folks do. And only 6% of white Americans say that racial discrimination against people of color is still a significant problem. I would point out that 12% of white America thinks that Elvis is still alive. So to the extent that only 6% of us believe that racial discrimination is still a significant problem, and 12% of us think that Elvis is still alive, that ought to tell you the depth of this denial. Only 6% willing to believe something that is fairly evident to an awful lot of other people, those who are victimized by that racism. But what's very interesting about this denial is it's not something new. You know, a lot of times people will say, well, I think the reason that denial is so strong is because, you know, ever since the Civil Rights Acts were passed, it's just become easier to assume that everything's better. And of course that's true, but if you go back to 1964, and 1963 and 1962 prior to the passage of the Civil Rights Act, when I think we would all agree now in retrospect, everyone would surely know that in 1962 opportunities weren't equal. Why today, you know, 37 years later, who would deny that? And the answer was nobody. We would all acknowledge it. What's interesting, you go back to 1962 and you read those Gallup polls then, and 60 to 70% of white Americans then said that people of color had just as much opportunity to get a good job and a good education and a good house as we as white folks do. In other words, we have this sort of retroactive denial, too. If you go back in history, you'll find, you know, now we say, well, 30 years ago it was bad, but today it's not so bad. But 30 years ago, we were saying the same thing, right? 30 years ago, we were saying, boy, back in the 30s, you know, it was really tough for people of color. But boy, we were in the 60s, and aren't we glad it's gotten better? And I have a feeling that if you went back and looked at polls from the 30s, they would probably say, boy, you know, that period right after Reconstruction was really tough, but now we're in the 30s, and everything is so much better. See, so this denial has a pedigree, if you will. And what's interesting about it is it's really the ultimate form of racism. What's interesting to me is that when folks deny the existence of racism, when they deny the existence of institutional racism in particular, they are in fact articulating the most blatant form of racism that there is. The denial is its own form of racism. So the minute that you open your mouth and say it's not a problem, you're guilty of it. And the reason I say that is because when white folks say this is not a problem, when white folks look at people of color and say you're not really experiencing what you think you're experiencing, you're not really getting looked at funny in the department store, you're not really getting followed around the white neighborhood, you're not really getting steered to black neighborhoods by real estate agents, you're not really getting redlined, you're not really getting prevented from job opportunities. What we are saying is that we know people of color's reality better than they know their reality. Now, I cannot think of anything more arrogant, and with regard to race, more racist, than to say, trust me, I know about your life better than you know about your life. We would never accept that from people of color, telling us that they knew more about our lives than we did. But we think of nothing of doing the same thing with regard to them. The reality, of course, which is fairly evident for those willing to do the research, and it doesn't take much time to do the research. I mean, the statistical abstracts of the U.S. that come out every year, the latest one came out just a few months ago, compiles all the data that you would ever need to know about equity and inequity in America, about wage disparities, about job disparities, about occupational status disparities, educational attainment disparities that continue to plague the country. The reality is that white college graduates are 2.5 times more likely to have a job 3 and 4 years after they graduate from college than an African American with a college degree, despite essentially equivalent qualifications. White persons with high school diplomas are, in fact, just as likely to have a job as a black man with a college degree. That is to say that a black man in particular who gets a BA, who gets a BS, has no greater likelihood of finding work, despite their educational qualifications, than the white guy who has no more than a high school diploma. In fact, even when you look at black households, I'm talking about African Americans particularly here, but these numbers are similar, although not quite as dramatic, but similar for Latinos, for many Asian Pacific American families, and certainly Native American families, where the data is unfortunately so badly kept with regard to American Indians that it's often even hard to talk about it because we just sort of acted like there aren't any more American Indians. You know, we sort of take this position, and the Census Bureau does a lousy job of maintaining the record. So if I don't speak about American Indians with regard to some of these statistics, please don't assume that that's because I'm not aware of the degree to which they have been silenced and made invisible. It's unfortunately the case that with regard to the data, a lot of the data simply isn't there. It's that badly kept. But with regard to African-American families, even when you look at those black families and white families that are similar in family structure, both parents in the house, both parents working, both with college degrees, the reality is that married black households continue to have a median annual income approximately 20% lower than white married households. So that despite the differences in family structure that some critics of affirmative action, for example, and some critics of my analysis about racism would offer, there is, even when you hold all those factors constant, a significant income gap in favor of whites and running to the detriment of people of color. And there are a lot of reasons why this is. It's not really a mystery, and I don't expect you to simply assume that what I say about it is correct. I don't expect you, you know, to trust me because we are in a society where, unfortunately, folks have been conditioned not to trust folks like me, you know, leftist extremists, as David Duke refers to me, or whatever, that, you know, I'm a leftist, or I'm an extremist, or I'm a radical. You're not supposed to listen to me because I probably just make stuff up. Okay, let's just assume that you shouldn't listen to me. Let me suggest, then, that you get it. You can get this online, the report, 1995 report of the Glass Ceiling Commission. This is a commission which was put together not by leftists like me, not by radicals like me, not even by liberals like I used to be before I moved through and transcended that, but by, quite honestly, people who were fairly conservative. The Glass Ceiling Commission was put together after 1991, about 1990, late 91, early 92, by George Bush, Elizabeth Gould, and Bob Dole. And that Glass Ceiling Commission's purpose was to study disparities in the workforce and to determine to what degree women of all colors and people of color, male and female, were excluded from job opportunities despite their qualifications. That was what they were essentially charged with looking at. And they did. They studied it for 3 years, and they released a report in 1995. And what the Glass Ceiling Commission found was that 97% of senior management, I'm not just talking about CEOs, I mean including executive vice president level management, were white men. 83% of tenured faculty on our nation's college campuses were white men. And it wasn't because those white men were more qualified in any objective sense that could be determined or measured. It was because, in the words of the commission, and I'll quote them directly, an ongoing pattern of injustice and rampant stereotyping, which was preventing perfectly qualified men, perfectly qualified people of color, male and female, from obtaining the positions to which their qualifications would otherwise recommend them. In other words, not reverse discrimination, right, but the same old discrimination that had gone on for years, and that is why that distribution of opportunities, that is why that distribution at the top is so skewed towards white men. As a result of stereotyping and bias at the highest levels of the private sector and in colleges and universities, not only are African Americans, about whom I've already spoken some tonight, and Latinos, about whom I haven't spoken as directly, but are clearly just barely less bad off in most of these indicators, and some indicators are actually worse off. The high school dropout rates, et cetera, are actually higher for Latino communities. But Asian Pacific Americans as well, who we often are led to believe are doing just fine. Asian Pacific Americans who were led to believe are all model minorities and they're all succeeding and they're all great at science and math and they all have their own businesses and they're all these, you know, millionaire entrepreneurs, which in fact, of course, is not true. And in fact, that model minority myth masks a huge disparity within the Asian Pacific American community and often works to the detriment of those at the bottom of the caste system, those most recent immigrants, Southeast Asian immigrants, also Filipinos, and many, even third and fourth generation Chinese and Japanese families that aren't doing nearly as well as the handful that we hear about in the cover stories in U.S. News and World Report dating back to the 60s, where they said, you know, all the Asians have their own businesses, why can't black people be like them? You see, that's the whole purpose of the model minority myth, is it's used to bash other people, right? You'll notice we never compare Asian Pacific Americans with white folk. We compare them with black folk. We compare them with Latinos, and we say the Asian Pacific Americans have a high index of business ownership, which actually isn't true. It's not true at all, but it's a common misperception. And we say, see, they're doing so much better than black folks, and if black folks would just save their money and pool their money and loan it to one another the way the Koreans do, you know, again, the Koreans, you know, they all loan money to each other. Again, very stereotypical racial thinking. We never allow somebody to say, you know, if all these folks would just sit around and do the things that white people do, we get offended when folks make generalities about what white people do. You know, if I were to say, if we would just go shoot up schools the way these white children do, you know, everybody would get offended. But they've all been white children. I mean, it's been a white phenomenon, the way that these mass murders have taken place, but no one would accept me saying that's a white thing. But somehow we say Koreans, they all lend, you know, money to each other, it's a Korean thing. See, we allow that. And that kind of mentality masks the fact that when you compare Asian Pacific Americans and whites in terms of income, that Asian Pacific Americans with college degrees are still earning anywhere from 11 to 15% less than whites with college degrees. And Asian Pacific Americans who only completed high school earn about 25% less than whites who only finished high school. So when we make the comparison at the top of the class and caste structure, which is still predominantly white, to Asian Pacific Americans, you get a very different picture. You know, and that's what I would suggest we do. Regardless of what group of color we're talking about, the bread is still very much buttered on the white side of the bread with regard to job opportunities and wages. Also, the same is true with regard to contracts, municipal contracts, federal government contracts, and that really hasn't changed a whole lot in the last 15 or 20 years, despite affirmative action, leading me to conclude, and I'll discuss affirmative action a little bit later, that if anything, affirmative action has been hardly implemented, rarely enforced, and as a result, has not accomplished what it was intended to accomplish. But just as it would be true that if you fight a war for 20 minutes and quit, you will probably not win. And I hate to use the sort of militaristic, you know, imagery, but unfortunately that's what we're used to in this country. You know, it's like, well, you're going to win a war, you have to really fight a war. Okay, the same is true here. If you don't really commit yourself to ending racism and institutional inequity, then you shouldn't be surprised when you still have some of it 30 and 40 years later. So whatever failures of affirmative action there have been either the result of inadequate enforcement, and of course 20-some-odd years of backlash and entrenchment by the courts and by the legislatures and by states like California and now Washington. So this inequity in contracting, the inequity in wages, the inequity in jobs continues to persist, indicating that the idea that we've moved through racial injustice and racial inequity and that there's no fighting or no battle left to be fought is obviously not true. The second myth that goes along with that one is the notion that white folks, whatever battle there is, that we're already on board, that we already support racial equity, that we're already committed to racial equity. And that, too, is largely untrue. Let me suggest that I'm not denying that in many ways, racial attitudes among white Americans have improved. I'm not saying that that's not true, but I would suggest that racial attitudes have improved from a point that was so god-awful that the improvement is something about which we should perhaps be a little more, to put it mildly. The reality is that even today, despite the improvements in attitudes, let's say from the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, which really ought not be our guidepost anyway to see how well we've done, because we understand how bad things were in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And I'm sure that in 1924, there were folks who could say, well, there were only 50 people lynched this year. That's better than, you know, 30 years ago when there were 200, so that's great. You know, this is, Malcolm X made the comment that you don't plunge a knife into a man's heart 12 inches, pull it out 6, and say you've made progress, because there's still a wound there that hasn't been healed, and there's still an injury that hasn't been undone. And I think it would be far better for us to think of it in that way. And even if we do think of it in that way, and even if we accept that there's been certain improvement in terms of attitudes, the reality is that racism, even of a most vicious kind, and I'm talking here about attitudinal racism, to say nothing of the institutional kind that I was talking about before and that I will talk about again with regard to equity of opportunity in various institutions of our society, but just in terms of attitudes, racism is still quite prevalent. We don't often think about it, but let me suggest to you the following. If you look at some of the recent polls, you'll find, for example, that only, and I put only in quotation marks, only 17% of white Americans will admit to pollsters. Now, understand, underline the words will admit, because people don't often tell pollsters what they really think about race issues, because we know it's unacceptable to voice openly bigoted opinions nowadays. And so my guess is this is an underestimation, but let's assume it's not. Let's assume that it's true that only 17% will admit to pollsters, and in fact that only 17% of whites believe that black people are genetically inferior to white people. When that question is asked, when the question is asked, do you believe that blacks have less inborn ability to learn, which is, you know, a question about biological racism. It's basically saying, is there an innate inferiority? 17% of white Americans today say yes. Now, granted, that's far better than 50 years ago, when about half or more would have said yes. So that's an improvement, don't get me wrong. But see, we hear these things, we hear 17%, and we go, man, only 17% accept Hitlerian views of race. And we think, I mean, it's really, you know, that's a Hitlerian view. I mean, you know, it's a view that is, you know, typical of a Mein Kampf type attitude, and also typical of a more recent bestseller called The Bell Curve, which was bought by a million or so white people, because last time, you know, black folks don't go out and buy books to find out why they're inferior, but The Bell Curve sold 500,000 copies in the first 18 months, it sold about another 500,000 copies, become a bestseller because white folks were willing to countenance this idea of black inferiority, which is really what the bulk of the book, in my opinion, is about. 17%, and so we hear that and we go, well, hey, if only 17% think that, that means 83% don't feel that way. And so the glass is, you know, half full, right, not half empty. The 83% now reject biological racism. Well, that's good. But do you realize exactly how many people 17% of the white community is? I mean, have you looked at the census data recently and really, like, done the math? I mean, I have bad math skills. I should be always with a calculator. I can't do any of it in my head. But I got the census data out, I pulled out a calculator, and I punched in the numbers. 17% of white America, willing to admit to, believing in the most vicious form of racism, we'll probably all agree, no matter whether you agree with anything else I say tonight, if you say that blacks are, you know, inborn less capable, you're a racist. I mean, that's 17% of white America, there are approximately 200 million white Americans. Approximately. About 197 million, but that is to say non-Hispanic whites, those that even David Duke would consider white. You know, you have to exclude Hispanic whites because the Census Bureau sort of muddies up these categories. But approximately 200 million white Americans, when you include those that are undercounted, because all the groups get undercounted, by the way. 200 million white Americans, 17% is approximately 34 million people. I would point out to you, there are only 34 million black people in the United States. So when you look at that number and you realize that for every black person in America, there is an overt white racist in America. Just by that number, not including those white folks that won't admit to biological racism beliefs but still view them that way, or when you talk about those white folks who maybe reject the bell curve but they accept what Dinesh D'Souza says, which is, in his book, The End of Racism, well, maybe it's not genetic inferiority, but their families sure are messed up. And they sure do have a dysfunctional culture, so they're cultural racists. When you add those on, that's like another 30% of white America that will cop to those views. Now you're talking about half of white America accepting either biological or cultural racism, about 100 million people. That's more, obviously, than all the blacks, all the Latinos and Latinas, all the Asian Pacific Americans, all the Native Americans in the country combined. And we act like this isn't a problem. We act like 34 million people, ha, it's no problem. But if 34 million overt white racists isn't a problem, why do we get so bent out of shape about all the black people in the neighborhood, right? Because it's one to one. For every black person, there's an overt white racist. For every Latino, Latina, who, if you listen to some of the conservative critics of the things that I'm saying, Latinos are taking over. Only 29 million of them, so we got more people overtly racist in the white community. If you don't think that 34 million overt white racists willing to admit to and acknowledge their bigotry can create a problem, you're obviously high. The interesting thing, and there's just no other way to say it, the interesting thing about this is not only are there an awful lot of white folks that are expressing overt bigotry, the bigger problem is that even those of us who are not those overt bigots, even those of us in the room, you know, having a good laugh at the expense of the 17%, you know, and pointing fingers at them, and, you know, they're on Jerry Springer, and you know, these are folks some of the 17%, although most of them are not in robes and wearing swastikas and burning crosses, let's be clear, but that's some of them, right? And so we see them, we laugh, and we yell at the TV, and like, you know, most white Americans reject that kind of silliness. You know, you tie a black man to the back of a truck and drag him through the streets of Jasper, Texas, everybody will stand up and condemn that. It's no problem. 6,500 African Americans die every year, according to the CDC and the National Center for Health Statistics, because they receive inferior health care relative to their white counterparts, and nobody says anything. And most of us didn't even know that number until I just said it, right? Because that didn't make the headlines, the way that an individual hate crime with an identifiable victim makes the headlines. 6,500 dead black people because they received inferior health care. Oh man, I don't know what that's about. Gosh, that's horrible, isn't it? Well, move on, you know. 2,000 or 3,000 more Latinos and Native Americans die as a result of it. There's about 10,000 people of color in all in a given year dying because of inferior health care. Even when you control, that's 10,000 who die after the controls for socioeconomic status. Okay. In other words, obviously some of that is because of inferior economic status, making it harder to afford adequate health care. But even when you control for that, you still have about 10,000 people of color a year dying because of conditions that are not solely related to socioeconomic status, but due to other inadequacies of health care in communities of color, right? Specifically in communities of color, because of uranium mining on Native land, because of a number of things that go on in communities of color that we wouldn't allow to happen in communities that were predominantly white. And the problem is that the rest of us, as we're yelling at those Nazis and as we're yelling at Klansmen and we're criticizing the overt racists and saying how foolish they are, the problem is that the rest of us are not doing enough to challenge those people and to challenge the institutions that reflect the biases of people like that, both in the past and in the present. So that, interestingly, you'll find that when you ask white people what they think about racial equity and if they support it, even, you know, it's interesting, 17% of the white Americans will tell you that they believe in biological racism, but only 3% of white Americans will admit and will say that they don't think we ought to have equal opportunity, meaning that 97% of whites will say, yes, we ought to have equal opportunity for jobs. Now, in other words, you've got people, even the ones who think blacks are, like, inferior biologically, saying we ought to have equal opportunities. And you know there's got to be some disconnect here between, you know, their two views that they hold at the same time. 97% say that we ought to have equal opportunity, but only 46%, less than that, say that there should be any laws on the part of the government to actually see to it that folks are treated equally. Understand, I'm not talking about affirmative action. 97% say we ought to have equity, but less than half of white Americans say there ought to be any law to ensure equitable treatment. That's the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Meaning that if it were put to a vote today, if you believe that poll, and it's been replicated 3 or 4 times now since it was first taken in 95, if you believe that poll, it means that if the white community had the opportunity to vote up or down on the simple wording of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 today, they would reject it, despite their claims to support equity. We exaggerate by a factor of God knows how much our support for the notion of integrated communities. We have a very interesting view on this, and there's a significant dichotomy between what white folks will say with regard to an integrated community and what they're willing to actually countenance and put up with. In 1993, for example, a study in Minneapolis found that 2/3 of the white parents in the suburbs of Minneapolis, school district, is it from? 2/3 of the white suburban parents said that white kids from the suburbs ought to be sent to the city schools, to the urban schools that were largely black in Minneapolis. 2/3 of the white parents in the suburbs said they ought to take kids like ours and send them into the city. But only 7% of the white parents actually sent their kids to those schools. You see, 2/3, 67% said they ought to do that, but then when it came time and they could have done it, I mean, all you gotta do is just send the kid, you know. No, we're not gonna do it. No, we're not We're not going to transfer to those schools. No, that's good for somebody else, but not me. The same is true in housing generally, even without regard to educational facilities like schools. The studies for over 25 years have shown that when a community becomes as little as 8% African American, that white folks begin to leave, first in very slow numbers. Once the numbers reach about 25%, the trickle becomes a mass exodus. Studies in Detroit found, for example, that 45% of whites said they would not be comfortable in any community that was more than or equal to a third black, because they said it would be a black community. But by definition, a community that's one-third black is not a black community. It is a white community with some black people, right? But they believe that that made it a black community. 30% of Detroit white folks said that they would leave any community that became a third African American. 6 in 10 said they would not move into such a community. The studies with regard to white folks' views of Latinos indicate a little bit less bias with regard to housing, but not much, hardly perceptible. A little bit less, again, with regard to Asian Pacific Americans, but again, not a significant difference, and there's still a significant amount of resistance to real integration. I would contend that what we really want is what I would call virtual integration. We want it on our terms. We only want a few of you. We only want you if you're like us. We only want you if you will make us forget that you are a person of color. We want the kind of black folks and brown folks that can come into a neighborhood and we can then sit around and go, you know, they're just so nice. They don't seem black, you know. I don't think of them as black. That's the kind of black people we want. Same thing with Latinos, same thing with Asians. It's the kind of people that make us feel like they're just like us. And at first you might think, well, that's sort of human nature. We like to be around people that are like us. But really, with regard to this issue, it's the epitome of racism, because it's the refusal to accept others on their terms as they wish to be treated, right? Even the golden rule that we all learned as kids is sort of inadequate to the task. The golden rule says, treat others as you would wish to be treated. No, you should treat others the way they want to be treated, not necessarily the way you want to be treated. Because in a racially divided and racist society, the way that white people might want to be treated may not be the way that people of color want to interact and want to be treated. And when we say we should treat you the way you want to be treated, what we're really saying is we should treat you like you're just like us, and not even recognize that there's a different history, and that there are things about communities of color that make them rich and different than the white community. And we don't want to do that. We want the amalgamation. We want the sort of sameness and the similarity. What's very interesting is we're not nearly as picky with regard to other white folks. I've had a lot of people, when I bring this up, they say, well, you know, it's not, I ask people in workshops, I say, how would you feel if 50 black families moved into your neighborhood, or 50 Chicano families moved into your neighborhood, or 50 Vietnamese families moved into your neighborhood? And every time I ask that question, and of course, it's a descending scale of hostility, typically, depends on where you are, but typically, like I live in the South, and so it's a descending scale. Most hostility toward blacks, a little bit less to Latinos, and a little bit less to Asian Pacific Americans, but not a whole big difference there. Pretty much impossible. And when you ask that question, folks go, because they don't want you to think that it's about race. Right? They don't want you to think that they're uncomfortable with people of color in their neighborhood. So what they do is they say, well, 50 black families, let's see, what's their socioeconomic status? You know, what do they do? What's their occupation? What's their educational background? Because understand now, I don't have a problem with black people. I just want to make sure that they're, you know, able to sort of fit in with the community. And okay, fine. And then I say, all right, great. We'll come back to that. How would you feel with 50 Irish families? 50 Italian families, 50 Polish families were to move in. And I'm assuming that the people I'm talking to are not Polish, not Italian, not Irish. In other words, if 50 families of a totally different white ethnicity and nationality were to move in, how would you feel? And every time the answer is, oh, whatever. I wouldn't think about it. They don't ask me, well, now, are they ghetto Polish? They don't ask the socioeconomic question. They don't ask, well, now let's see, now what is the professional occupational status of those Irish? I want to make sure they'll fit in. What's funny is we may not have anything in common with these white folks. Right now we are resettling refugees from Kosovo in Nashville and a lot of other communities around the country. There's obviously huge cultural divides between the Kosovars who will be coming here and most of the communities to which they will be moving, and yet you don't see the same level of hostility. And it's not just because of our humanitarian ethos that says, oh, these are people being oppressed and run out of their homes and then bombed by us and all this other stuff. It's not just that. It's about the fact that we are able to identify, in many instances, with anyone with white skin before we're able to identify with many of the people who live down the block from us or in the next neighborhood if they have skin of color. That is to say, you can see this evident in the labor movement for many years as well. I've talked to white working class guys in unions, and I've seen them interact more positively with white folks who are not in the union, who in fact are working often at wages that undercut prevailing wages and undercut union wages. They have more in common with the white guys in their neighborhood who are not in the union, who are willing to scab at their company if they go on strike, than they are with the black folks and the Latinos who work on the line with them. This is in manufacturing jobs in particular. And you ask them why that is, and you don't get an answer. In other words, there's more of an affinity and an attraction just simply on the basis of skin color that trumps all these other similarities, and it certainly plays out with regard to so-called integration. It's certainly prevalent here at the University of Oregon. As I said, I've only been here for 36 hours or so, and in that time, I've heard an administration representative say that among the most significant commitments that this university has is greater diversity and greater mix of students and greater equal opportunity for students of color, that it is one of their primary obligations and one of their biggest commitments. And when I hear a comment like that, and I hear it at every school I go to from administrations that haven't come anywhere near the goals that they set, as minimal as those goals were, I have to call that statement what it really is. Whether it's intentional, whether it's understood to be this by the person who utters it, the comment is a lie. And it is a lie because anything you are committed to when you're an institution of this size and with the resources of an institution of higher learning, you will accomplish. The reality is that when this school sets capital improvement goals, when they set up a goal to build this building, which they had to raise money for, right? They had a commitment to get this building built. They have a commitment to get other buildings built. They have a commitment to increase their endowment. And have you ever heard of this school or any other school setting a goal for fundraising that they didn't meet? And if they didn't meet it, are the people responsible for meeting it still around? No, they're fired. That's how you judge a commitment. You judge a commitment because when you say, this is a goal and this is your job, and oh, you didn't do your job, see ya, find another job. But that doesn't happen. Now, it would happen if they said, we're going to get this building built, and whoever's job it was to raise that money didn't do it. They'd be gone. That's a commitment. That is a priority, right? But nobody's head rolls if they don't meet their goals for diversity and representation and equity. Nobody gets fired for that, right? So the reality is you can judge a commitment based on results, not based on the words that are used. The reality is, and I find it very interesting, you're in a state that is sandwiched between California and Washington. Two states that have just made clear their hostility to diversity on their campuses by passing 209 and I-200 in Washington. And you have students of color who are now, in large numbers, not even applying at the UC, not even applying at UW. We've had a significant drop-off because students are saying, even if I could get in, I don't feel comfortable, I don't feel welcome. Now, that seems like that would be a real coup for the University of Oregon. Because this school could go to California and to Washington and say what? Say they may not want you there, but we want you here. You were in between two states that had made clear their hostility to people of color. You could pick off those people of color like ducks in a pond, and it isn't happening. In fact, the numbers are dropping at the same time that people of color are being turned away in those two states. Now, how is that possible? Yeah. If there is a commitment, let alone. The reality is I just don't believe it, and here's how I can prove it for anyone who isn't convinced. I did this today in the workshop, and I think most people agree with the point I was making. Let's say, hypothetically, that I was a multi-billionaire. I'm not. But let's say, hypothetically, that I was, and I had a whole lot of cash. Let's say I was film money. And let's say that I woke up tomorrow and I decided, you know, I don't want another building with my name on it. And I realize that I have to make up for a lot of the stuff that my company has done, exploiting sweatshop labor all around the world and lying about it. And so now I've grown a conscience, and I realize one of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to go to the University of Oregon and offer my services. I don't want any more buildings in my name. I don't want to just make contributions for libraries or law schools or whatever it is. I want to use my money for only one purpose, two purposes, to go out and recruit both students of color and faculty of color and pay them to teach here and attend here at no cost to the university. Now follow my train of thought. Let's say that I'm feeling like I got all this money and University of Oregon says they're committed to more faculty of color, and they're committed to more students of color. Okay, let's play this out. Let's see how committed we are. I'm Phil Knight. I got all this money. I'm going to spend a year going all around the country, going to the stage. I'm paying $75,000 to start.
if you'll come and teach at the University of Oregon, creating an obvious incentive for the scholars of color, number one, and because I'm willing to pay it, the school doesn't have to pay a penny. I'll come to the president of the University of Oregon and say, I'll pay their salaries for you. You won't have to spend a dime. I will bring 50, 70, 100 new faculty of color to the University of Oregon at no cost to you. Do they take me up on it? Think about that. Ask yourself, how quickly would they take me up on that? Somebody suggested today, well, they would have to form a commission to look into it. And my guess is that the decision would not be favorable. Because if you bring 100 new scholars of color onto this campus, see, it's no longer the same university. In the minds of white parents, in the minds of white people in the community, in the minds of most white students. Let's take the other example. Let's say that I, Phil Knight, say it isn't enough to get 100 black and Latino and Asian and Native faculty. I'm going to go out and bring 500, let's say, black kids. And you can go out and you can find it. I mean, you can find 500 more black kids to bring onto this campus. There's no question in my mind about that. You can do it. So let's say Phil Knight decides to do it. He goes out. What's the number now, like 220, 200, a little over 200 or something like that? Let's say he's going to double it, he's going to more than double where it is now. Get 500 new black students and bring them onto this campus. He'll pay to transport them here. He'll pay for them to move their stuff here. He'll pay their tuitions. He'll pay their room and board. He'll pay all of it. Again, no cost to the university, and you just got 500 bright black students to come to this campus, which would more than double the current numbers. Do you think that the community, the administration, the trustees, the president, the administration generally, and many of the white folks in the community of UG would be happy to see 500 new black students unloading their stuff on orientation day and during orientation week? See, I have my doubts, and I can't prove this. You know, you're here, and you probably have a better sense of it, but I just have a feeling, and if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, right? But I have a feeling they would not be happy about that. They would not be happy about that, because in fact, whatever commitment they have to diversity, it's this virtual diversity, it's virtual integration, just enough to put the black folks on the website and to put the Latinos on the brochure. So they can send it out, so they can meet their affirmative action goals and not get in trouble with the government, but not that they have to change fundamentally anything, let alone the underlying culture of white domination that exists at this school and any other school. And don't get me wrong, this school's no worse than any other school about the hypocrisy and the inconsistency. This school's no worse about the duplicity, but you're also no better. The good thing is that there is a base, as I've said many times since I've been here, of students and faculty that I've met, and staff, and people who clearly are committed here to creating a different situation at this school. And so I would suggest that you take advantage of that foundation, which is, in fact, much stronger here than it is at many schools around the country where I travel. Sometimes I get so depressed when I go places because I don't see that. I don't see that hope. But last night at that award ceremony, I saw students of color who were clearly ready to forge and willing to forge a different reality at this campus. But you have to be clear about exactly what it is you're fighting for, and you can't be deceived about who's on your side and who's not on your side. Because if they were on your side, it would get done. And you have to recognize they're not, and then you have to figure out how to work against that reality to change that reality. The final thing that we do that I think indicates that we really don't have a clear conception of what it means to be anti-racist as white folks, and we're not really committed to equity, is that we exaggerate, and everyone I'm sure has had experiences with this if you're a person of color. White folks tend to exaggerate by a factor of, you know, 10. How many, you know, all the black friends that we have, all the brown friends, all the friends of color generally that we have, you know, you'll hear it all the time. I'm not a racist, I have black friends. I'm not a racist, I have Latino friends. I have friends of all different colors. Very interesting, there were some polls done on this recently, very telling. 1997 Gallup poll found that 3/4 of all white Americans, 75%, say they have close friends who are black. And not just one or two, but many, many close friends that are black. 75% say that. So I pulled out the Census Bureau data, and I pulled out my calculator, and I multiplied the 200 million white people by the 75%, I came out with approximately 146 million people. 146 million whites say they have close friends who are black, and many of them. But there are only 34 million black people in the United States. Now, I was not good at math, as I said, but I know there's a problem with these numbers. Because what that means is, ultimately, that either a lot of white folks are mistaken about just how many close black friends they have, or there are a couple of black folks doing like triple duty, quadruple duty, being friends with like a whole lot of white people. Like, black folks have no time to do anything other than be friends with white people. These numbers are true. So again, we have a misperception because we live in a society where we accept this virtual equity, this virtual integration, virtual diversity. We see black, you know, most of us.